Hi, this is Anna Nguyen, and you're listening to Critical Literary Consumption. I want listeners, readers, and writers to ask themselves about their own reading, writing, and analyzing practices. Some questions that I always am asking in so many words are, when you cite a text or an author, what do you think that citation is doing? And are you erasing the authorial voice, whether intentionally or not? My guest today is Dr. Chanda Prescott Weinstein, who is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy and is also the core faculty in women's and gender studies at the University of New Hampshire. She's also a columnist for New Scientist and Physics World. Her research in theoretical physics focuses on cosmology, neutron stars, and dark matter, and she's active in Black feminist science, technology, and society studies. Her book, The Disordered Cosmos, A Journey into Dark Matter, Space-Time, and Dreams Deferred, is a critical rethinking of science, time, space, and academia, themes we discuss in the conversation. Chanda, I've been following your Twitter account for a couple of years now, and I think of your tweets as giving me some sort of progression into your book. So I want to ask you, what eventually became The Disordered Cosmos? How did it start after your blog post, which you had cited at the end of your book? What changed? What narratives did you take out? And what narratives did you want to put in the book? Because it was released really recently, and there were a lot of references on the current social movements and this idea of making science better and just a general academic crisis.
So there are, I guess, a few different layers to this question, which is the first is that the name The Disordered Cosmos comes from a blog that I kept while I was in graduate school. So I think I started it in maybe 2007. Mm-hmm. And I wrote the blog until about 2011 when I was wrapping up my first year as a postdoc. And one of the reasons that I stopped blogging at The Disordered Cosmos actually was because I was noticing that people were clicking on blogs less frequently, that people were just writing really long Facebook posts. And so in some sense, the audience that I had was my Facebook friends at that point in time. And so it didn't make as much sense to put all the effort into maintaining the blog and writing things there. And what I did on the blog was, I was in my, mid-20s when I started it. So I was writing about science. I think that that's like really where I was, trying my hand for the first time at writing science for a general audience, even though it was like a small number of people. And I was also starting to do some of the early sociological analyses that sometimes pop up on my social media about the number of Black women who had PhDs in physics and bachelor's degrees in physics and that kind of thing. Those were my first like forays into trying to draw attention. None of what appeared on that blog actually ultimately ends up in the book, right? Because then I started writing the book in late spring of 2019.
Okay.
So this is many, many years later. But there's a direct connection in the sense that the blog is where I start first practicing this attempt to articulate all of these things that matter to me at the same time in one space as a kind of continuity, as opposed to, oh, this is the side that cares about fighting racism, and this is the side that cares about quantum gravity, but actually I can care about all of these things at the same time. And I think that The Disordered Cosmos, the blog, is where that first starts happening. As for the book itself, by the time I sat down to write it, I had the opportunity to publish in a few paying publications, online journals. I had one print publication in Bitch Magazine, which was an early version of the chapter, The Physics of Melanin. So I would say 30%, less than 30%, 25% of the first draft of the book was based on blog entries that I had subsequently written at Medium, because then blogs became a thing again. There's like a whole
Substack
text story here. And now we're in newsletter territory, We've moved from blogs to newsletters. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the journey of the form. I didn't realize how much stuff would get edited on the other end. So the final mm-hmm. version, I think, looks quite different from what those first pieces of the first draft look like.
Whenever I read an author and a scholar's work, I try to read multiple pieces to understand mm-hmm. their perspective and then the reaction after the book has been published. And so I found your recent Catchable piece. I know we had talked about this offline. I think even in one of your tweets, you reference where does your book sit in a bookshelf, like the genre I think you were talking about. I remember that tweet. So when I read it, I thought of it as a critical look on conventional understanding of institutionalized science. And there were some personal experiential writing and then your future hopes for what does a better science and better future look like. And in the Catapult piece, what really struck me was that you wrote that, and I'm quoting here, "This was still not my childhood dream," which you also had written in your book. So I wonder, in your book, you tell your readers you wanted to be a scientist of the universe and tell stories about the world. And even if you were able to write whatever you wanted, were there limitations of writing your book? Or how did it help you achieve your childhood dream? Or how did it not help you achieve your childhood dream? Or even visionary imaginations of science, which you wrote in the in chapter 4?
Yeah, big question. I think the thing that I want to start with is the limitations. Mm-hmm. Maybe in part, you know, the subtitle of the book, so it's The Disordered Cosmos, A Journey into Dark Matter, Space, Time, and Dreams Deferred. Yeah. And Dreams Deferred is the place that you're left with as you open the book and start to read, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a meta comment on the book itself, like to have that on the cover of this book that is in part a representation of dreams and dreams deferred simultaneously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I thought one day I was going to write my own version of A Brief History of Time. Mm-hmm. And that's not what this book is. I still dream of doing that. And I still mm-hmm. think that I will do that one day. But I think that first I had to write a book that talked openly and honestly about what science is and the doing of physics. And that meant talking about, you know, what's exciting about physics, but also what's broken about how we do physics together to the extent that we even do physics together. Mm-hmm. Like, what does together even mean, and who counts in that word? You know, I think that part of the writing of this book was also working through the fact that even when I sit down to write what I think will be my brief history of time, it still won't be like Stephen Hawking's book, because my perspective is always going to be that of someone who is critical of how science happens and wants to drive us to do science better, and that I necessarily bring a different perspective to it. I mean, I think the other thing that's interesting is that, just staying with Stephen Hawking in particular, is that he ended up having two vehicles simultaneously for storytelling. So he had the book, A Brief History of Time. And then he also had this documentary that Errol Morris made about him at around the same time. And actually, my introduction to Stephen Hawking was not through the book. It was through the documentary, A Brief History of Time. And in that documentary, Hawking is certainly telling not just his scientific story, but also his story of journeying through science as a disabled person. Mm-hmm. And so in some sense, I think, you know, one way of thinking about The Disordered Cosmos is that I reflected the work of the documentary more than I reflected the work of the book, which is to holistically bring all of these things together. I think that that's one limitation. There is another limitation that I want to address, which is that I get hate mail and death threats. And the entire time I was writing, I was asking myself the question of, you know, is the sentence going to be the sentence that pushes someone, or I shouldn't say that I did it, like I pushed them, but is this sentence going to be the sentence that someone uses as an excuse to threaten me? And it's not that I got nothing to write the book. I got an advance. But the advance I got will not pay for my security costs if I have escalating needs. And that was a consideration. And it was a conversation I had with my agent throughout the process. So I want to point out that that was a limitation, which is, you know, maybe there are things I would have said like in a more visceral way if I felt safe to. And that really says something about the state of the quote free speech discourse in this country.
If I may ask, the death threats that you received, was it because they thought you were critical of science, or I don't...
There have been waves of it at different times. So like one time I called Thomas Jefferson a rapist on Twitter. The tweet kind of flew under the radar, but there's an organization called Campus Reform that purports to be student-driven media.
Okay.
That initially made its name by attacking Black women academics, and in particular, and has since gone on pretty much anybody who's sympathetic to people of color, particularly like Black people or Palestinians, in academia. And they basically train students who have conservative views to take this approach to academics that they disagree with. And they searched through my tweets and found that tweet and turned it into a story. So then it was like, she hates America, which, like, by the way, if I did, I would have a right to.
Right.
It's a quote, a free country, they keep saying to us, right? And then, you know, the other thing that really tends to set people off is when I say things that are critical of Israel, when I say things that are pro-Palestinian. I would say like a significant portion of the angry mail that I get and also the hate mail that I get is actually from white Jews.
I also saw some of your conversations about...
Yeah.
I seem like I'm outing myself as an avid Twitter reader, but I use it for discourse. Okay. So if I sound, you know, like I know too much about your tweets, I'm really sorry. But they really helped me formulate the questions and the understanding of...
Yeah. I appreciate the level of care that you brought to the research for this. So that's what I'm hearing.
No, thank you so much for that. If we could return to your catapult piece, you also wrote that many publishers want you to write primarily personal stories. And so I'd like to refer back to that tweet that you were talking about genre and what does a genre mean for your book and how you situate your work. When I went to the Harvard bookstore, I went there because they hosted your talk with Kieze, who's our mutual friend. So I think you found it in the new releases, but where would you like for your book to be situated and in conversation with?
So it's funny that you framed the question in terms of the Harvard bookstore in particular, because like the very first time I really had to think about this was when Kiese was there on the paperback tour for his memoir, Heavy. And, you know, he's one of my good friends. And so I had gone to support him. And when I went to give him a hug afterwards, he said, "So where in this store at the Harvard bookstore is your book going to live?" And that was really, we both kind of sat there and went,
He was one of your readers for the book, I remember, right?
And you know, in a lot of ways, like he was the first editor who got me a paying writing gig. In so many ways, he's at least partly responsible for me having any kind of like public writing career. And he's been like a mentor, a sibling, a cousin, like all of those things. So it's funny to that because, you know, I live partly in Cambridge, that Harvard bookstore, the reason that we wanted to do the opening night event there was because I consider that to be my home bookstore. And I have since I was, you know, a sophomore at Harvard living in Adams House right around the corner. And it felt very fraught for me that like, what if my home bookstore locates the book in a place that I don't want it to be? Like, what if they put it in the Black Studies section, which I think is sometimes, I'm trying to remember how it's labeled in that store. I want to say it's labeled as African American biography. So it's not even labeled as Black Studies, right? Or is it going to be put in the feminist studies section, which for people who've never been to Harvard bookstore, it's basically divided into like three rooms. And the science section, feminist studies, and Black studies are in different rooms. So they wouldn't even be in the same, because like the feminist thought is right next to the new releases table in front of the cash register. You can tell I know the store like really well. Or like, you know, and then there was also, you know, the other thing that I'll say is that as it was starting to get rolled out, I realized that it was being labeled as a Black book, that it was being labeled as a women's thought book, as a feminist thought book. It was being labeled as a science book, which, as you know, I had fought for, but it wasn't being labeled as a queer book. And I realized that that was starting to bug the crap out of me, given that has this whole through line right down to, since you've been following on Twitter, you might have noticed over the weekend, this tweet, I think it's chapter three, Space Time Isn't Straight, went viral.
And was it Natasha Lyonne who?
Yes, she was one of the people who retweeted it. I think she saw it because it had gone viral. And of course, like importantly, I was really excited about Natasha Lyonne because she starred in But I'm a Cheerleader.
Yes, yes, I saw the
the summer that I came out was the summer that it got wide release nationally in movie theaters. And I was a summer student at University of Chicago. I was doing research there. And I trekked across Chicago 2 weekends in a row to watch that movie. And I dragged people across the city with me to watch it twice. You know, at the time, I still strongly saw myself as cisgender and cissex female. But the public narrative about that was everybody was butch. And so I didn't really have like a location for myself in that. But I'm a Cheerleader is basically about that, right?
I think it's really interesting that this kind of the word studies at the end of anything, I think actually that kind of interdisciplinary and openness of studies actually could exclude as much as it includes. And I'm saying this as someone who is restarting her PhD program in an American studies department in Germany. After giving a presentation, I think there was a moment where I was supposed to justify what is American studies about this. I think people aren't being honest when they want to locate something as if it's a definite, absolute answer. So like in the case of bookshelves and bookshops, does it need a permanent home somewhere? I'm not sure. And I think reading your work, I think this goes to my next question about your actual prose in the book. So you spend some time talking about particular scientific theories, but you're always critiquing it simultaneously as you're explaining it. So you have critical race studies, you have some STS. So I wonder, when we talk about your general readership, who do you think is the book for and how should they be reading it if you're trying to make some sort of critical exploration of what does science mean to us now and what does it mean for us to talk about science as if it's the singular greatness thing? And where do you see it fitting in into this bigger study of how do we make science better for the non-hegemonic people participating in it?
So I think the book is for everyone. There are limits to what I do in the book. And some of that is limits to what I'm competent to do, right? And I think it's okay to not be competent at everything. I was actually just making notes to myself about the Ambe book club event that I did last night. And I want to get her name right. I want to say it was Celeste Smith. Celeste Smith, I wrote down, knowing everything is a Western concept. You know, the story that I could tell was especially focused on, you know, the legacy of colonialism and white supremacy in the Americas, and especially in the North American context. And so I don't think that that's the only context out there. Like, I actually feel like I find myself explaining to people a lot. There's a lot of weird essentialism that can go on in thinking about who's capable of being awful and who's capable of being colonial. And so I'm always urging people to learn more about like Japanese colonialism in Asia. As someone, you know, who's married to a Taiwanese American and who has spent a lot of time in Korea, where anybody who's spent like, you know, just a little bit of time in Korea knows that the wounds around what happened under Japanese colonialism are still very open and very present and very, very visceral, right? Even for readers for whom that might be their primary context and European colonialism isn't their primary context, my hope is that the book will provide an example if this is one way that this conversation can be had, and this is one way that these critiques can be had and done, even if the specifics change and the groups that you need to talk about shift and the cultural specificities are quite different. I think even in the context of, yes, this book is very focused on a particular geography and rooted in the experiences, especially of the Black Atlantic, and also to some extent, the Indigenous Atlantic and the Indigenous Pacific, that I do think that there's a story there for everyone. Mm-hmm. I think even for people for whom they feel anxious when they think about math and science, I think the hard thing that I had to kind of sit with as the book started to roll out was that people experienced interacting with the fact of the book as if it was a textbook. Like, oh, I'm going to be tested on this on the other end. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to describe to you exactly what a quark is and what the relationship between a quark and a gluon is.
String theory.
I just want people to like have a moment where they read about it, they learn a little bit. And the other thing is that when I've had conversations with people who have said, you know what, I really feel like the science went over my head. Mm-hmm. Then they start describing to me what I wrote in the science sections. Uh-huh. And I'm like, it sounds like you the science, it. You yeah. got it. Yeah. Right. Like maybe you didn't memorize every single word, right. but you have the gist of the situation.
Well, I know like in chapter two, when you were describing the Euclidean Newtonian theories, so you were describing that. And then you were talking about, I think you were talking about your menstrual cycle. Even if the science did go over my head, I remember how you would choose to interact with the hard scientific theories. I actually thought, even if I couldn't understand it, at least the way you chose to interpret it, I thought was very accessible in that you were trying to say something, I think that you had already mentioned this, but Western-centric context. But I think a lot of it was also embodied knowledge. And I thought that was a nice take on how does one sit with the scientific language that one's not used to. So I thought that was actually really nice personal vignettes that you wove in as you were explaining.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And, you know, again, I think that one of the interesting things that I have learned from readers is how we have all been socialized into particular self-assessments around our competency with science, with math. Which is that people assume that the science has gone over their head.
Yeah.
Right. And also that, you know, just juxtaposing that with the fact that you never hear people say that about Black studies or gender studies or ethnic studies. And I think I say a little bit about this and at the end of the acknowledgments, even though I wrote the book in conversation with a lot of people. And in particular, one of the people that I wrote the book in conversation with is my spouse, who actually has a background in ethnic studies. His undergraduate degree is in ethnic studies and political science. He's trained as a civil rights lawyer. He won awards for his writing about like Asian American politics and history. I think there's this weird assumption that those concepts are easier to grasp than the physics ones. But actually, my spouse had to spend a lot of time teaching me what it meant to read. When I sat down and read like Brown v. Board, the Supreme Court case, he had to teach me to understand what I was reading and not to interpret the text the way that I would interpret a novel that I picked up, but to understand when a lawyer says this word, this is what they mean. And that's an expertise that we all have to learn. And so I think probably what's happening is that some things are going over people's heads, but they're trained to think they're easy. And so they don't even realize that they are.
So in my conversation with Kiese, we were talking, I think it was towards the end of our podcast chat. He was speaking that everyone should read really broadly and try to learn the jargon, that it does take practice and care. So I always think that he has very interesting ideas on how to use social theory in everyday lives. And this goes to my next question about this kind of idea of social phenomena and social constructions. And you wrote about that science is basically a construct of white scientists and it has had a place in our hegemonic understanding of science at large. In chapter five, you talked about colorism. I can't remember the exact term. Were you saying you don't like the term race science because you think it should just be called racist science?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is that I definitely wrote that. And it's definitely the case that in the interim, I have fallen back on using race science. And part of that also is that these changes to language are always a community conversation, right? And so as long as people are saying race science, if I say racist science, and there isn't like a broad understanding of what I mean by racist science, then I can see that people might interpret that as me. I'm specifically talking about, you know, eugenics, when race science is actually in some ways broader than eugenics. Like, and so racist science is broader than eugenics, but that might be what it calls to mind for people. But I do think that there is something to be said for thinking about the way that using the word race instead of racist is a passive analysis, as opposed to saying actively, this is science that is actively racist. Or actively producing racism and actively producing race.
So Chanda, I don't know if I told you, I'm in the SCS program. I'm a fellow in the Harvard crowd. And so I wanted to ask you, because it's very commonplace to hear someone in my group or a presentation by SCS scholars say that science is socially constructed by a community of scientists. But I find that even when we have somewhat accepted that, I tend to think people have accepted science as an actor, passive, assertive, aggressive, whatever, but it's not really an analytical category. And so how do you situate your work in an SCS crowd or even in Black feminist studies? Because that's also an emerging field, because Ruha Benjamin, she comes often to our fellowship events and stuff like that. And you do cite her, I remember.
Yeah, I'll mention in context of you being in the STS program at the Kennedy School, that one of the regrets that I'm happy for this opportunity to say it out loud that I have is that I don't cite Sheila Jass enough, which I should have. And particularly if we're going to be talking about science and society co-constructing, I think it's such a common refrain in the STS community now that it can be easy to forget that it wasn't always a common refrain. And it speaks to the power of her scholarship, that this is now just like such normative language that it seems like it's always been there, even though that's not quite how it is. And I do think one of the things that's very striking to me when we're talking about science, technology, and society studies in particular is how white STS continues to be. Even though at this point, science and society co-construct is like something that if you're not talking about that, are you even doing serious STS? And I think it's really revealing about how many people in the academy envision society and the limitations on their perspective on what constitutes society and what constitutes a society that can influence science. So I think that that's one thing, which is that, you know, I hope that in the last year, maybe we're starting to see the confidence in this limited vision erode. You know, I have a long list of complaints about Joe Biden, but it is interesting to have a white, old white man president who says that systemic racism is a problem. That at least like it's a thing that you're now expected to say out loud is a change. I don't know how many lives it saves, but it's a discursive shift. So, you know, that's interesting. The other comment that I will make about STS as a discipline, and as someone who came at it, socialized in a completely different discipline, earning my PhD in a completely different discipline, and growing up with community organizers, is the focus on technology is quite interesting to me, which is when people say science and society co-construct, very often they're saying science, but what they mean is technology. Right. And I think that this goes back to, you know, what Joe Martin writes about in Solid State Insurrection about prestige asymmetry, that it's more prestigious to talk about science and things that are considered scientific than it is to talk about things that are technological. And that's a class thing that goes back to, are you thinking lofty thoughts about the heavens, or are you thinking about like factory related capital things, which is like, sure, it'll make you money, but then you're just nouveau riche, right? As opposed to a gentleman who was born to think about the sky, right? And I think that we live with that consequence that people still kind of think of technology as like science's dirty cousin. And that we are all socialized into that. Like even scientists are socialized into that. Like theoretical physics is considered more prestigious than experimental physics within the discipline. The theorists are considered the smarter ones than the experimentalists by many. And I think that's a reflection of, you know, what's considered technological and what's considered scientific.
Okay.
But I find that really interesting. And I would even go so far as claiming that even though STS likes to say science and society co-construct, I'm not sure that STS has bought into that yet. Mm-hmm. And I think that STS has stopped at technology and society co-construct. Mm-hmm. And we actually need to take that extra step with science. Mm-hmm. And then to the extent that people have taken that extra step, like, you know, feminist philosophy of science, we'll take as an example, but it's not just life science and society co-construct, but also physical science.
I'm glad you bring up the limitations of STS critique and methods. There are two separate tweet threads that I think maybe you had gotten involved with both of them in some sense. Do you remember MC Hammer's tweet about...
The one responding to the attack on philosophy?
Yeah, I actually thought it was a very thoughtful...
Yeah.
Tweet. Like he
I
said,
it was good.
Philosophy and science, you have to know both to be able to think about the broader questions of society. So there was a back and forth. And then for us, you know, they were trying to say, what books can we recommend for MC Hammer? And he wrote, LOL, The Audacity. And
so yeah, then, that was terrible. I was one of the people who retweeted it and was like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. So within some of the threads, some scholars who said that, you know, this is probably time for STS scholars to think about their lack of actually talking about inclusion, or at least Black studies scholars who intersect with STS. And then I like to contrast that situation with MC Hammer with Neil deGrasse Tyson when he wrote, the good thing about science is that it's true, whether or not you believe in it. And he wrote science was a proper noun. And, you know, when I wrote this question and I had my partner look at my questions, he said, I wonder if China's tired of being asked questions about Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh man, there's so many things I could say about this. So let me go in reverse.
Okay.
Regarding Neil, as I wrote in Scientific American, when the sexual misconduct accusations first came to a head, you know, I'm always going to believe victims about, you know, the alleged sexual misconduct. Mm-hmm. It's also the case that he at points played, you know, a valuable role in promoting my success. And so it was a hard thing to come out and be like, look, you know, thanks for being nice to me, but also I believe the victims.
Yeah.
What I will say specifically about that tweet in connection with that is that the way that Tyson and his team tried to discredit the woman who came forward, I think I'm saying her name right, Takiya Ahmet, was by saying that she believed in a bunch of new age stuff. And so they tried to undercut her credential as a rape victim by undercutting her credential as someone who could think rationally. Mm-hmm. And that's what came to mind for me when I read that tweet, is I was like, that's interesting. He has a set of things that he classes as science that are simply true when you say them. But if a woman says that she was sexually assaulted, it doesn't fall into that category, right? So I think that's probably, you know, in some sense, that juxtaposition highlights the problem for us. The underlying question, which is like, who gets to be an observer and what constitutes an observation and what constitutes sufficient either direct or indirect circumstantial evidence for verifying whether something is true or not. I think that piece with NDT is interesting. I'll be honest and say, I actually haven't been asked a ton of questions about him, maybe partly because people have read the Scientific American piece. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I was very careful to say to people, I don't want my book compared to his books. I mean, partly because my book doesn't do what his books do. Like even if, you know, I didn't have these other concerns, when we were talking about what the cover of the book would look like, I actually very proactively was like, this cover cannot look like the cover of one of his books. I didn't want to invite that comparison. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about the incident with 4S and the Twitter account and MC Hammer was I felt like the person who ran the Twitter account got thrown under the bus a little bit, in the sense that like that person definitely messed up, right? Because it was their tweet. But then kind of what came out was like, oh, well, this person's just a graduate student and you guys are dragging them and being really hard on them. And there were a series of questions that come out of that, which is like, well, why did you all First of all, what training has this graduate student received that it produced this kind of engagement with MC Hammer? Mm-hmm. That's step one, right? Which, like, if you're going to say this person's a graduate student, then you have to take responsibility for the fact that they're receiving training.
Right.
And someone fell down on the training job there. Mm-hmm. And that is a reflection of the community. You can't put that on the student.
Right. The institutional community. Yeah.
There's an institutional failure that is reflected mm-hmm. by that. You know, the other thing is that I'm happy for graduate students to have jobs where they get paid, but like, is the graduate student getting paid to do that? And if they are getting paid to do that, mm-hmm. why did they take the job? Did they take the job because, like, you know, they want to go skiing every weekend and it pays their ski? Or did they take the job because wherever they're doing their PhD doesn't mm-hmm. pay a sufficient stipend? And so yeah. they feel like they have to do this other thing on top of it.
Yeah.
So for me, there were labor questions mm-hmm. and institutional structural questions that couldn't really be addressed by just saying, like, oh, it was like this one like screw up by a graduate right. student.
Yeah. I couldn't remember Joan Fujimara's response. Did she say that the heads were going to take more control over the tweets? What was it?
So yeah, I don't remember exactly what it was, but mm-hmm. all of it was this kind of like, yeah, but you're still the president of the organization mm-hmm. and you have to eat this.
I don't know. When I saw that tweet, I thought one could read it as maybe they're just trying to do like this branding moment. Like, what kind of expertise could we help to have MC Hammer connect with our community? But that's just like a generous reading of it. But why would you assume that MC Hammer hasn't read those books? Because he had already listed his picture, the library books, you know?
Yeah, I agree. When it comes to like social media and handling when people mess up on social media, to me, that account wasn't one person. That account was the organization.
Yes.
I still see it that way. I don't think it was mm-hmm. one person who messed up. There's the fact that the tweet went out, that the person thought it was okay to write the tweet, that they're receiving training that doesn't inoculate them against writing tweets like mm-hmm. that. That's all multiple institutional failures.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I do think that one of the problems we have with critique on social media mm-hmm. is we have a lot of people who are trained in critical analysis or who are picking up critical analysis. And I sometimes joke to people that it's like all that critical analysis and like nowhere to go.
Oh my gosh.
So sometimes people are like, I'm going to find that one screw up on Twitter. And then I'm just going to like eviscerate the person mm-hmm. because I don't have anywhere else to apply
right.
this training I mm-hmm. have.
So I think Disha is the one who brought me into using this word nuance. It doesn't have to be definite and final, but you can mm-hmm. engage, be critical.
At the Ambe book club meeting yesterday, which was streaming live on Twitch, that was my first time being on Twitch, Daniel Heath Justice, who is the author of Why Indigenous Literatures Matter, was also on. And in the concluding comments he made, he talked a lot about the importance of being wary of simple solutions mm-hmm. that we have like ideas about the ways that we want the world to be different. And we think that maybe there's a simple way to get there, but that we should actually be really careful about thinking mm-hmm. that these things can ever be simple.
Right.
Rather than sitting with the nuance and the complexity of the situation.
I'm also reading Kathy McKittrick's Dear Science. I consider them as part of a bigger citational project and like who to cite and who do we not cite. I love her footnotes. And I know you were in conversation with Kathy McKittrick. I've noticed that you both really have this deep love for literature, and then you use it as a way to think about narrativizing existing voices that haven't been put into certain, I don't know, disciplines, programs. You use a lot of literary citations. What do you think literature brings into the scientific discourse when there has been a longstanding binary between literature, humanities, and science? And do you see this binary being dismantled or at least carefully reimagined about the possibilities of both fields?
you know, the interesting thing about Dear Science, and I've talked about this elsewhere, is that Catherine and I were sort of writing in parallel with each other, and at the time didn't know each other. And I say sort of because, as you can see from when the letter at the end of her book is dated, she finished that book before I started writing mine. And so hers is, I believe it's dated in January of 2019. I started writing The Disordered Cosmos. Really, like, I sat down and was like, all right, here's how it's going to unfold, in like April of 2019. And we didn't know each other. I didn't know anything about Dear Science at that point. And so I think the thing that continues to be striking to me is that we both ended with letters.
You to your mother, right?
And yeah, I think it's to science, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have my copy sitting right here too. I actually have three copies now. I have the advanced version that she sent me when I was preparing to interview her. And then I got paranoid that I hadn't ordered an actual copy of it. So I ended up with two. And I have to say, it's one that I'm happy to have multiple copies of because it's such a rich text. I'm happy to have it in on my couch library, as my spouse calls it, and also one on my desk. And it is very striking to me, like, how we wrote in parallel in some ways and in conversation with each other. And, you know, going back to what you and I were just talking about with regard to like the 4S Twitter account, something like that, where we're both going in the same direction, is clearly indicative of a larger social moment that is not just like, hey, that's an interesting coincidence. It says something about where Black feminist thought is in relation to science. And I think also, you know, in a way that I am definitely influenced by her. She was clearly working on Dear Science for a really long time. And I'm, you know, I was coming of age in an environment that had been shaped intellectually by her. And so even if, you know, there was a point at which I wasn't reading her yet, that I was still being shaped by this environment that she had helped produce. I think that there is that element of that, which is that she is both, you know, my friend, and I would say now mentor as well, but also part of my intellectual genealogy. And there are many people who I think, you know, create that fabric together, but I think that she's part of it. And I think that what her book is doing is telling us in some sense about how much literature is part of that fabric, how much Black thought is part of a fabric that co-produces Blackness, right? And you see that in like funky ways in my book. I have a section where I talk about Mansfield Park, which is probably not something that people were expecting to see in my book.
I didn't know.
For better or for worse, I have questions about my decision for the letter to my mother to reference a Tupac song, given the fact that Tupac faced charges associated with sexual assault and went to prison for them. And I continue to struggle with that as someone who is anti-carceral, but also, you know, as a survivor of sexual assault. But I think, you know, the thing that we are both saying at the same time is that Blackness is whole and not incomplete in the ways that people want us to think it is incomplete, and that that includes science.
Chanda, my last question, and I think it goes back to the first couple of questions that I asked you. In your last chapter, you end with a normative call for rethinking what you want science to do in the world. And it's very apparent to me that you do love science, you love physics. But it's not without careful considerations of what it could do better as a whole. So you write that science has to move past talk of ethical conduct and toward anti-colonial action. So how can we do that without simply organizing more DEI communities, which I see as always the kind of the aspiration after particular tragedies in our current world? And I also see this often misuse of decolonization as a metaphor for institutional change. And I know that you cited Tuck and Young.
Yeah. Here, I'm going to say something to students in particular, which is that students need to stop getting bamboozled by equity, diversity, and inclusion. which means stop being satisfied by the creation of a committee. Mm-hmm. Stop referring to yourselves as diverse, for goodness sake. And, of course, I was just saying that, like, there's an institution, people are being trained, but this is why I want to talk directly to students. You have to resist the socialization that trains those of us who are not het, cis, able-bodied white men to mm-hmm. refer to ourselves as diverse. Mm-hmm. And to think that we will find justice in an equity, diversity, and inclusion committee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the example that I've been giving to people in the very few talks that I give on this subject now is, what does diversity and inclusion do for Tamir Rice? It does nothing for Tamir mm-hmm. Rice. I actually showed that slide yesterday in a talk and changed it to say Micaiah Bryant, because now yep. I'm a 16-year-old girl. And I have to say yeah. that I'm actually having a really difficult time with that this week. I don't know if it's just like there were one too many and I can no longer yeah. stomach it in the same way that I was stomaching it. But equity, diversity, and inclusion does nothing for that. Like the police officer who murdered Dante Wright, and in my opinion, it was a murder, was a white woman. But a woman, right? So diversity, the police force was diverse. What did that do for Dante Wright? So I need students to stop putting that in their demands. I have lots to say to, like, all of the faculty and everybody else about that. And I think I say that a lot in the book, and I say that a lot on social media. But I do think that students have a role to play in this ecosystem, which is that it's still the case that when I'm reading student demands, mm-hmm. That people are still saying, and form a committee about this, make the faculty more diverse. I think the demands need to be more specific. Mm-hmm. We want Black faculty who are competent at mentoring students from marginalized backgrounds. Mm-hmm. We want the university to recognize that Black faculty can do research in fields that are not on race. And so, you know, the faculty plans can't always just be, and we're going to hire some ethnic studies scholars that we then chase off in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Hire some Black scientists too.
Thank you for listening. You can reach me on Twitter and Instagram at @AnnaDroid. I'd also like to thank Mariah Behrens for creating the cover art for my podcast, and my partner, Matthew Sample, for his music and edits. See you next time.